ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Look at that, at the last minute, the dark horse going, gone, sold for $701,000.
The property market on the Sunshine Coast in Queensland is tight, but house hunters are having some luck finding gems at auctions held by the public trustee. We're going to have more on that. And a regional council's plan to buy back homes plagued by a colony of bats.
And if you're not going to fund dispersal of this colony to another location, then you need to buy out these homes. They are worthless. No one would go and purchase a home and have bat excrement and noise 24/7.
And we meet a couple of enterprising young comic authors.
Snaps is a crocodile and Jude's a bull, a red bull. And Blue Boy, he's a fluffy creature. And there's Chili Dog, he's a dog with a chili tail.
Oh, what's her superpower?
When he farts, it's hot and spicy.
Ooh.
I'm Sinead Mangan, and this is Australia Wide, coming to you from Whadjuk Country Park.
It's absolutely.
Is that an RBT?
You can play contest for cocaine.
Good evening, sir. Drug and alcohol testing station. Sir, your drug wipes returned a positive result to cocaine. What a report.
A new ad from the South Australian Police Force warning drivers of the dangers of driving under the influence of illicit drugs. The message? You'll get caught. At the same time, the Queensland Police have revealed since it started testing for cocaine in July 2023, almost 1,500 drivers were driving under the influence of the narcotic. The culprits were caught by roadside testing that involves police taking a sample of saliva that generates a result in a matter of only 3 minutes. Police across Australia have widened the net in the types of drugs they test for roadside, and one of the reasons being is in Queensland, 49 deaths on the road were because of drugs, which has now surpassed fatalities involving drink driving. Russell White is the chair of the Australian Road Safety Foundation. Now, Russell, these numbers, I mean, maybe I'm living under a rock, but these numbers seem a little alarming. How big is the problem of drug driving?
Yeah, Sinead, I think it's more than just a little alarming. I think one of these things that I guess when you have a blitz or you have these sorts of new levels of enforcement with police is just the sheer scale of the number of people that they're catching with sort of all sorts of chemicals or drugs in their system. And I think, you know, for a long time, alcohol testing was probably our main line of defence. And I think to a certain degree, because people couldn't be tested for drugs, it's probably they were probably rolling the dice a little bit more with that in terms of their own safety and the safety of other people. So as we see more drug testing become available, and I guess more police resources focusing on that, I'm with you. I do fear that we're going to see a fairly significant number of people driving around, you know, whether it's more those harder substances or even some of the, I guess, the more moderate ones, but anything that's going to affect your driving performance is a problem. And being able to test for that and have rigorous testing for that is something we've got to start looking at more from an overall road safety standpoint.
As you said, the tests have widened their scope. They can now test for more substances roadside, including obviously the alcohol. We're all very familiar with that. Do you think it's simply that there is more data, or is it that people are actually taking greater risks?
Well, I think, as I said before, when you police, and I know from police colleagues that I know around the country, but certainly the ones that I know of in Queensland, if you did a blitz, say, in regional areas of Queensland, quite astounding the number of people that you get showing positive results for that. And so I think, you know, drugs is a problem right across the nation, but certainly there's probably more complexity in regional and remote parts of the country as well, where again, people's views and usage of those sorts of substances maybe of that view that they just won't get caught. And because of that, and it sort of gets woven into the culture a little bit, that people don't realise it's a risk sometimes, or they underestimate the risk just because they may be doing it on a fairly regular basis. But as I said before, anything that's altering your state, whether that is drugs or alcohol, is going to have an impact on your on your driving performance, obviously, then also your safety and the safety of other people.
As you said, there is kind of this misconception that, and it's in the ad there, in the South Australian ad, that the hook is that the driver believes he can't be caught because he hasn't been drinking. I can't say that I've ever been tested for drugs, but I have been breathalyzed. Do you think that's a common misconception? I didn't realize that this was happening so readily.
Yeah, and I think if we historically take a look in the rearview mirror, I think if we look at how when random breath testing first came out, I mean, it was heavily marketed, heavily promoted, and I remember when it first came out, there was a pretty strong chance you were going to get pulled over, and certainly those sorts of testing stations were very visible. You know, the old booze bus days were very visible, and so I think, you know, they tended to create a culture then, and it did drive that sort of view that driving whilst, you know, if you'd had something to drink, was socially unacceptable. And that had changed the narrative from what it had been, you know, previous to that. I think one of the things that has been the challenge with drug testing is the complexity of it. As I said, the various types of substances that will affect performance or state or physiology. You know, alcohol testing is fairly straightforward, and it's relatively cheap to do. And I think that was one of the things that when we were first starting looking at drug testing, you know, the cost of I can't remember the exact figure off the top of my head, but it was a fairly minuscule amount to do an alcohol test. Doing a drug test was many, many, many times more expensive and more complex. So I think that was, we've always been on that search, I guess, to try and have a drug test that is as easily done and as cost effective as an alcohol test would be.
And now, obviously, that cost has come down because it's more prevalent.
Yeah. And I think that's the thing. We've got to start, I guess, when we're looking at road safety figures and the fatalities and injuries that we're seeing now, and it's alarming how much our road toll is increasing year on year. You know, we have to start looking at new ways to not only, I guess, apprehend people doing the wrong thing, but also, you know, improve people's awareness around safety. And I think this is part of this narrative that not only is it about increasing testing and the increase in the likelihood that you'll get caught and you know, doing the wrong thing, but also then trying to change this narrative, like we did with, as I said, with drink driving. We've probably got to turn our attention now to some of these more difficult substances like drugs.
We've always known that speed is a major issue on rural and regional roads, but you mentioned Queensland there in terms of drug driving. How big a problem, or do you know, or is there data around how big a problem drug driving is on country roads nationally?
I haven't got any data directly in front of me at the moment, but I do know, like I said, from those reports I'd had about, I can't remember the exact numbers, but it was horrific. And I think in those regional areas, again, with COVID, post-COVID, that sort of environment, we're probably seeing increases in the levels of those numbers of people using sort of those sorts of drugs. So I think it is a problem that we're only just scratching the surface of. And I think it's something that as these tests now become more frequent, then there's going to be, I think, you know, we might be shocked by just how the number of people that are getting caught with drugs in the system.
The Australian Road Safety Foundation has recently launched a regional campaign looking at driving in the bush. And we all know that fatalities and crashes on the roads in regional Australia, it's a constant scourge for the community. Like, you know, it really is quite sad, the number of fatalities that happen. The statistics suggest that not much has changed. Why is that? Why is it that it's not something that seems to ever improve?
It's a great question. It's the thing that keeps me awake at night, and it's the thing that sort of drives the work that we do at the foundation, is to try and look at the reasons why. I mean, it's especially concerning at the moment because our cars are we've probably got the safest vehicle fleet we've ever had. In fact, that's fact. You know, our roads can certainly need more work, but they're not undrivable, and you know, we're starting to see significant year-on-year increases to a point now where, unfortunately, last year we lost, you know, 1,300 people. Now, we haven't had that figure since, you know, 2007, 2008. So we've been used to this trajectory downwards of reductions in road trauma. And, you know, as I keep reminding people, you know, in 1970, our road toll was nearly 4,000 people. So it's still well below that. But I'm concerned that with this onward sort of year-on-year increase, you know, how much longer before we're starting to get to those sorts of figures again? And so, you know, I think any increase in road trauma is a cause for concern. When we're seeing it year-on-year, and it's significantly year-on-year, then we've got to start looking at doing different things, because what we've been currently doing has got us here, but it's not going to be enough to see us through the future. And I think that's where things like education, like this sorts of things I'm focused on drug driving, those sorts of things, how are we preparing people for the road? Those are all critical areas that we need to improve our performance on, and look at the human factors around road trauma, not just focus on vehicle safety or engineering alone.
As part of unthreading the issue, the foundation has done some research and asked people, you know, their thoughts around driving on regional roads. And one of the pieces of information I found really interesting was that some people thought it was safe to break the law on country roads. That seemed peculiar to me. What's that about?
Well, I don't think they think it's safe to do it. I think the thinking is the risk of getting caught is less, and so that tends to ultimately change behaviour. Just as an ambulance goes past on its way, hopefully not to a road crash, but I think there's a general attitude that somehow a country road, because there is less traffic, that there's less risk. And, you know, whilst a rural road is certainly more scenic, and that's, you know, there is less cars, or there are less cars, the risks are different. You're travelling at a higher speed. You make a mistake on the road, there's going to be significant consequence for that. And, you know, again, if something happens on the road in those areas, it can take a long time for someone to reach you to administer first aid or try and rescue you. So they're the sorts of things that there's a double-edged sword on a rural road, less traffic, but just different sorts of risks.
There's an awful lot to talk about. We'll have to talk again. Russell White, the chair of the Australian Road Safety Foundation, thanks very much for talking to Australia Wide.
No, my pleasure, Nate. Talk soon.
ABC Australia Wide.
Let's head now to Queensland, where the property market is booming. Every year in the state, between 300 and 400 properties go under the hammer, and they're sold by the public trustee. Now, they're often from deceased estates, and usually it's a bit of a mixed bag. But sometimes the auctions take place in the hottest real estate markets, including beachside and waterfront homes on the Gold and Sunshine Coasts. Jessica Ross has this story.
$560,000 I've got there. If you want to be the high bidder, 570, number 89.
About 30 people are crammed into this one-bedroom unit on Queensland's Sunshine Coast.
670, she says. 670 over there. There's an audible gasp from someone.
The property's in dire need of repair.
We are not trying to disguise that at all. I'm sure you've all got eyes. Stevie Wonder can definitely see this property needs some love.
At the entry, auction attendees are confronted by an exposed wall with insulation spilling out. The second floor units encased by a mix of painted and bare brick walls, with retro yellow tiles adorning the kitchen and partially built bathroom. But here it's what's outside that counts, with ocean glimpses from the balcony and Alexandra Headland and Malulabar beaches just a short stroll away.
84681, look at that, at the last minute, the dark horse.
Local lifesaver Sophie Marks manages to outbid her four other competitors.
Going, gone, sold for $701,000.
I wanted something different, to be honest, because I manage a plumbing company in the Gold Coast, but I work from home, so I'm a big part of Malulabar Surf Club. I volunteer down there most weekends, so I wanted something nice and close. I train down there every day for surf life savings, so I wanted something close to home, and I wanted something different. I didn't want what everyone else wanted, so that's what I got.
The unit belonged to the late Gregory McLean, an architect who lived in London but would return to spend 3 months on the coast each year. His two sisters are at the auction. Faye McLean even gives Ms. Marks her brother's plans to redesign the unit, which was sadly never realised.
Well, I've given them the drawings that he had done to get started, because the plans are for a three-bedroom, two-bathroom unit. That's what he was going to do. And then COVID hit.
Yeah.
So he never came back, and then he got Parkinson's, so he's died in London. So, yeah, now this is an ending for us. It's closure.
Often the public trustee has been appointed executor of an estate as part of the distribution of assets in accordance with a will and may be instructed to sell the property. The unit is one of 10 Southeast Queensland homes auctioned off by the Queensland Public Trustee in the past week.
It is random due to the nature of how we get our properties, you know, the nature of people's lives and when they come to us, it is really random. Sometimes we have four or five properties in the round at the coast, sometimes we won't have any. Sometimes they'll all be Brisbane-based.
Paul Gaffney is the public trustee's principal auctioneer and has seen the auctions becoming more popular.
We probably average about 8 to 10 registered bidders per auction. In the private sector, they probably are happy with 3 or 4 registered bidders at an auction. So we definitely get more on average, and that competition helps create a better sale price in the end. We don't sell properties cheaply, but on average, our properties are cheaper because they are run down and they're in need of renovation and a bit of TLC. Probably 80 to 90% of our properties are renovators. It is usually a home that someone has lived in for 40, 50, maybe 60 years.
The Queensland Public Trustee's final round of auctions for the year will be held in the second week of December. By then, Ms. Marks hopes to have started work on her Renovator's Delight, which she plans to transform into her dream home.
I'm a tradie. I know a lot of tradies, so we'll be busy.
Lucky that she's a tradie. Proud new unit owner, Sophie Marks, ending that story there from Jessica Ross. They're noisy, smelly, and they make a really big mess, but play a crucial role in our ecosystem. A Queensland community has become fed up with a growing population of flying foxes in what used to be a quiet residential area in the heart of town. The Gympie Regional Council has floated an extraordinary plan to buy back affected homes near the colony, but it needs government support. Jake Kiernan has this story.
In the heart of Gympie, home to more than 20,000 residents, a small gully surrounded by houses has been overrun by flying foxes.
It was only about 4 or 5 years ago that the bats arrived in this area. So, there was a big fire and they sort of all migrated to Gympie.
Residents like Chris Nevin, who live near Commissioner's Gully, are becoming fed up with the noise, smell and mess.
Bat droppings. And their impact on our trees, because when they're hanging off the trees, they actually weaken them and they start collapsing. So in the storm the other night, we had a couple of trees actually fall on our fence.
At a recent meeting, the Gympie Regional Council endorsed a new management plan to address the roost. As part of the plan, Gympie Mayor Glenn Hartwig has put out a drastic call for the state and federal government to fund a property buyback scheme for affected homeowners. In a bid to discourage the bats from taking roost, the council has installed sprinklers and lighting features to disperse the animals, but all attempts have failed.
And I think the federal government need to acknowledge that if you're going to create the problem, you need to fund the solution. And if you're not going to fund dispersal of this colony to another location, then you need to buy out these homes. They are worthless. No one would go and purchase a home and have bat excrement and noise 24/7.
He says state and federal legislation protecting the species has made it difficult for council to manage the roost.
It's very, very frustrating for council. We've spent significant amounts of money, doing some vegetation management. We've put sprinklers up in the tree, which basically we just need to provide them shampoo and they would have a shower every day. I mean, those things don't work.
In Queensland, flying foxes are protected under the Nature Conservation Act and at a federal level under the Environment Protection and Biodiversity Conservation Act. University of the Sunshine Coast ecologist Professor Claire Storsky says the mammals play a crucial role in the ecosystem.
Well, one of their main roles is that they pollinate lots of plants, particularly in Australia. They're the sole pollinators for a lot of our native species. So without them, a lot of our native plants would become extinct because they wouldn't have anyone to pollinate them.
Even with a robust dispersal management plan, the data is discouraging.
I think out of all the dispersal attempts that have occurred over many years in Australia, not even a quarter have been successful, and they usually take a really long time. Some individuals will stay there for like 10 days and then they'll go to another camp for 10 days. So when you're trying to disperse them, not all of them might be there. So that's why it can take a really long time, because you're constantly having new ones come back.
The Gympie Regional Council is hopeful the state and federal government will provide funding for a potential buyback scheme. Residents say it is something they would consider.
Only if it got us completely out of debt and set us up for another place, pretty much, because we do have a mortgage here and there are 11 of us living here. So it was hard to find a property that would house us all.
State and federal governments say they already provide additional support to councils dealing with Flying Fox issues. Both declined to say whether they would fund a property buyback scheme for affected homeowners.
You've created the problem. The only way to fix it is to either fund council and change the legislation so that we can actually do some measures that will mitigate the issue, or buy out the properties and give these people some peace of mind.
Some sound, a colony of flying foxes, I can tell you. Gympie Mayor Glenn Hartwig finishing that story from Jake Kiernan. A former stonemason is changing the face of Bathurst in New South Wales, but instead of using a chisel, he's got a spray can. Callum Hotham didn't know how to draw 4 years ago, and now he's decorated 25 walls in his hometown with portraiture and landscapes. Our reporter Lani Otaway in New England has more.
Callum Hotham grew up visiting this butcher shop in South Bathurst.
I used to come down from the sale yards, which is not too far away. My pop used to select the cattle and sheep for Graham, who still works here at the butcher. They were great friends, and yeah, so we'd go straight from there to here and they'd have a chat. And to like be back here again doing something that's gonna probably outlast me is just, yeah, just very grateful.
Where he walked past its blank brick wall as a child now stands a giant mural.
This one here is the Keenan Co mural. We wanted to incorporate Mount Panorama. Obviously, it's so iconic, and the South Bathurst Butcher Shop here is just down the road from the mount. So we definitely wanted to put that in there. And we wanted to incorporate like a cattle farm kind of look as well. We've got two cows on the right-hand side. And then on the left-hand side, we've got Kyle, who's the owner of this butcher shop.
He finished the monochrome mural on the weekend at the Bathurst 1000, which attracted some spectators.
When he was doing it, there was a lot of people stopping and staring and watching, and I thought we might have seen an accident, but no, everyone was pretty good. And
butcher Kyle Keane had seen the murals slowly transforming the town and wanted to bring his own wall to life.
What we were really aiming for is like when you get Mount Panorama, the 1000, and people coming through, that's why we put the Mount Panorama in there as well, and sort of trying to have it like you get the silo art where they go around and check out all the old silo art. So hopefully this will be in all of Callum's other murals, will be something like that as well, where they can go around and check them out and have a look from there, yeah.
Callum Hotham's driving me to a particularly personal artwork at his childhood cricket ground. It's one of about 25 murals in the city he's painted over 3 years on schools, businesses and sports clubs.
We're standing in front of the Bathurst City Colts mural of Bob Clancy, the founder of the club. He's such a lovely fella and everyone knows him for that. So like when I was taking the photos, I wanted him to have like a slight grin just because it just gives off his character, I guess. So he's also in his 70s, I think, and if I've got that wrong, sorry Bob, but so like I wanted to sort of exaggerate the wrinkles and stuff like that and the highlights because it often looks really good in paintings. So yeah, and like just with his eyes, they're quite watery and he's just like a lovable character, so I tried to really capture that.
Callum Hotham's hyper-realistic portraiture isn't the product of years of formal training. 4 years ago, he was living in Sydney and working as a stonemason. He felt inspired by the city's street art and picked up a pen to try drawing. He progressed from experimenting with pencils to paints to spray cans.
I just fell in love with painting with spray cans because there's such a technical side to it, and it's not that you're just getting better at painting, it's also you're getting better at controlling the can, which I'm really fascinated by.
He developed his style in Sydney and painted for businesses in the city's west, including at NRL star Nathan Cleary's brewery, before moving back to Bathurst. Callum Hotham credits retired real estate agent Peter Rogers with starting the momentum for his murals.
I believe our CBD in Bathurst is dead. You know, there's no lights, there's nothing happening of a night.
Peter Rogers commissioned him to revive a brick wall that was 50 metres long and 10 metres tall. He wanted it to reflect the town's history.
We'll do it on the gold theory because that's what the buildings were. It was like a big hardware or a Myers where you could buy anything there in the old days, and they supplied all the gold miners.
3 months later, the mural Eureka was finished, with kids panning for gold, native birds and Mount Panorama Walu in the background.
Now that Eureka has come up, and we're getting people from all over Australia coming to look at that, because it's actually on the Silo Art Trail. They're people that are visiting. And the next thing is, if they're grey nomads, which we get a lot of them, they'll go to the camping. They say, oh, gee, did you see, have you been through Bathurst? There's a really nice lot of murals there. So it creates that tourism, which is what we try to get here.
Marianne Jakes from organisation Arts Out West says he's an exciting artist, not only because he's from Bathurst, but also because he's self-taught.
If he was painting or working a couple of hundred years ago, he'd be the guy that you would hire to get your portrait painted if you're very rich.
She believes businesses can benefit from advertising while providing public art for the community at the same time.
Bathurst, I think, does feel really proud of those works. I have seen every time he does a new work so many comments on social media from locals who are celebrating that and championing someone from their community.
And for the artist himself, he says he feels deeply grateful for the town's response to his work.
This is so cool to think that I was, you know, a little kid here, and now I guess I'm leaving something here that's going to be longer than me.
Bathurst artist Callum Hotham finishing that story from Lani Otaway. Finally, let's head to Cairns in Queensland to meet a couple of young authors. Their books feature fart jokes, snot balls and undead monster sharks. And that is because these comic book authors and brothers, Carter and Marlo Wright, are only 9 and 10. Here's Amanda Cranston with more.
Two brothers from tropical North Queensland are published authors. Their books feature characters like the stink-eyed butt dragon and a dog with a chili for a tail. That's because these two writers are aged 9 and 10.
We were reading lots of graphic novels from our school library and we just wanted to write a book.
Brothers Carter and Marlo from Cairns came up with the characters themselves.
We started creating them and drawing them and Mum helped us and we started with Gully and Tab.
And given these characters have come from the imagination of two young boys, they have some pretty out there superpowers.
Tab's a bat and he's super smart. Gully's a seagull and he's got an electric jock shock.
Electric jock shock? How does that work?
He can shock people with his jocks?
Yeah. Snaps is a crocodile and Jude's a bull, a red bull, and Blue Boy, he's a fluffy creature. And there's Chili Dog, he's a dog with a chili tail.
Oh, what's her superpower?
When he farts, it's hot and spicy.
Ooh.
What started as a dream of writing a book by these two young brothers quickly became a family affair. Mum Maddie helps to map out the storyline, and it involves a bit of a takeover of their home. Their hallway is full of drawings and page plans stuck on the wall.
Because our hallway is central to our home, and so everywhere in our home that you stand, you can see our hallway. And I started to do it as a bit of a reminder for the boys that, hey, when we get home from school, we're going to work on this. And that was our agreement. If they wanted to make a book, they had to stick at it because this is hard work. And originally they wanted to make a 200-page book. That was what they said.
How many pages is it?
It is 200 pages. Yeah, each book has been 200. This is us starting book number 3 on our wall right now. And we literally start with one page at a time. And as we send the boys' ideas to Stu, the illustrator, he'll work on it and then he'll send it back and the boys will edit it. And when we've got it done, I'll print it off at home and I'll swap their page that they've hand-drawn for one of Stu's pages so they can actually see the book develop into a real-life book over time.
Always a work in progress.
Yeah.
Mum Maddie says the fact the books are written by kids for kids is having a huge impact on young readers.
I don't know that the boys understand the gravity of and the impact that they're having on other kids. And I don't know that they'll know that until they're maybe a bit older and they'll look back and go, oh my goodness, we did that. And that's okay, but I think it's just they'll never forget this experience. And our family will never forget this experience. I think that's the best thing about it is we actually can do this as a family.
So far, two books have been self-published and a third underway with the help of an illustrator. The boys are aiming for a six-series run, even if sometimes there's some creative differences.
Carter, who comes up with the best drawings, do you think?
Me. No, me.
Amanda Cranston speaking with Marlo and Carter Wright, and you also heard their mum, Maddie. And that is Australia Wide for this Wednesday with me, Sinead Mangan. Cheerio.
ABC Listen.